Good afternoon. It's another Sunday here in the Paris of the South, Asheville, North Carolina. Welcome to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, my co-host, Sebastian Matthews, off on the West Coast today for a reading of his own work. And speaking of the West, we're going to celebrate today one of the really paramount poets, I think, of the American West, though he's best known probably as a Black Mountain College poet, and therefore probably used to hang out here in the city. Hitting Ma Peaks on occasion in Black Mountain. That's Ed Dorn. We're going to begin with a reading of his longer poem, Idaho Out, an early work.
In any case, briefly, Edward Dorn, perhaps most easily identified as a member of the Black Mountain group of poets who took their direction primarily from the example of Charles Olson. Edward Dorn has published one book, one collection, The Newly Fallen, printed by Totem Karn, and has work in the New American Poetry Anthology, edited by Donald Allen, for those of you who want more background. And he will have equally prose in another collection edited by Donald Allen, New American Prose, coming out sometime later this year. And other lists of poems. He's finished a novel recently and has two more collections of poems presently in manuscript. So let me now, with great pleasure again, introduce to you Edward Dorn.
Thank you very much. The first poem I'm going to read is from a collection, and this is the title poem. It's called Idaho Out, and it's no more than a reference to a place and some time spent there at one given point. It has a quotation at the beginning from Carlos Sauer, the geographer. And it goes, "The thing to be known is the natural landscape. It becomes known through the totality of its forms." Since 1925, there are now no negative areas he has ignored. The poles have been strung for our time together, and his hand is in the air as well. Ariel is hopefully Ariel. So black and red Simplot fertilizer smoke drifts its excremental way down the bottle of our valley toward the narrowing end. Coming in to the Portneuf Gap, where its base aspects, a large cork could be placed, but which proceeding from Income or toward past the low roofs of sheep sheds, the slope gains rough, brusque edges, and you are in it more quickly than its known forms allow. Or the approach from the contrary side of the valley, there is a total journal with the eyes, and the full gap stands as the grand gate from our place to Utah Badlands and thus down to those sullen valleys of men who have apparently accepted all the vital factor of their time, not including humanity. And not to go too far with them, they were the first white flower makers. Thus, aerially, they jealously keep that form and turn the sides of the citizens' hill into square documents of their timid endeavor. The only hard thing they had was first massacre and then brickwork, not propaedeutic to a life of grand design wherein all men fit, but something for all its pleasure of built surface and logic of substance as the appeal of habitat. For Salt Lake downtown is not ugly, but to a life of petty retreat before such small concourses as smoking, drinking, and other less obvious but justly necessary bodily needs, not including breeding, which in their hands is purposive. From this valley, there is no leaving by laterals. Even George Goodhart, a conventional man, as all good hearts are, knew, with a horse and access crosswise to creek heads, the starving Indian women could be fed with surplus deer. Who was the pioneer boy who died in a rest home and was a new local? That is, there is implied evidence he never heard the cry of the Pawnee in his territory, which it is said in the human ecology term is to be a hick, howsoever traveled. And while we are at it is best said here, the mark of the pre-communication Westerner traveled in local segments along a line of time utterly sequestered. Thus his stupidity required the services of at least one of his saddlebags. And in the meantime, his Indian friends signaled one another, another over his head as he passed on his businesslike way in the depression between them in long shadows, they looking deaf and dumb, moving fingers on the slight rounds of Nebraskan hills. Of a verge of the land north, and an afternoon is no good, there is the width of the funnel rim, and sad people for all their smiles do scurry and sing across its mouth, and there are no archipelagos of real laughter in Alameda. And no really wild people save stiff, inhibited criminals. So when gay youth was yours in those other smaller towns on the peneplain of Central America and the Jerseys, the white legs of girls stand truly by stoplights, and Edward Hopper truly did stop painting all those years. But we stray, we strays, as we always do, and those mercies always wanted an endless price. Our jazz came from the same hip shops we walked past, the truly, in no sense speaking of universes, hanging from that hook. I had in mind the sweet shop, something so simple as Main Street, and I'll be around. But I was escorting you out of Pocatello, sort of north. Perhaps past the physiographic menace, the Arco Desert, and what's there, the leakage of new clear seance to Limhi, again a Mormon nomenclature, were plaques to the journey of Lewis and Clark, but the rises across the two tilted floors of that corridor, at High Point the Birch, and then toward North Fork, you must take that other drainage where, yes, the opposites are so sheer, and the fineness of what growth there is that lifting, following, of line, the forever bush, and its thin-colored sentineling of those streams, as North Fork comes on the banks of the magnificent Salmon, we come smack up on a marvelous beauty from Shy, who has a creaky cheap pool table to pass the winter with, and the innocent, loud-mouthed, handsome boys who inhabit the winter there, the remarkably quiet winter there, all alone with the Salmon Forks. It is so far away, but never long ago, you may be sure, Hudson. And, she said, shaking her dark hair, she used to work at Arco and knew the fastest way from Salmon to Idaho Falls, you may be sure, in a car or anywhere. She was a walking invitation to a lover party. Her body was that tactile to the eye, or what I meant, she is part of the morphology, the last distant place of Idaho North, already in effect Montana. Thus, roughly free to bring in relative terms, her husband, though it makes no difference, had sideburns, wore a kind of abstract spats, wore loose modern beltless pants, and moved with that accord to the earth I deal with that only the heavy people are with. They are the pragmatic, and they're always unequated remnant. My desire is to be a classical poet. My gods have been men and women. I renew my demand that presidents and chairmen everywhere be removed to a quarantine outside the earth somewhere as we travel northward. My peculiar route is across the lost trail pass, passed in the dark draw somewhere. My North Fork beauty's husband's dammed up small dribbling creek, fetching a promising lake, she showed me the picture. A too-good-to-be-true scheme, she explained to me, to draw fishermen with hats on from everywhere they wanted to come from. One of the few ventures I'd given my blessing. She would look nice rich. We were hauling furniture to Missoula. We stopped in the biting starlit air often to have a beer and to stretch our legs. My son rode with me and was delighted that a state so civilized as Montana could exist, where the people, and no matter how small the town and how disconnected in the mountain trails, could be so welcoming to a lad, far from the prescribed ages of Idaho, where they chase that young population out into the frosty air. There is an incredible but true fear of the trespassing there of such patently harmless people, age 13. But not to go too much into that ethnic shit, because this is geographic business. Already in the Bitterroot, there's that snow on the tallest peaks, and that moisture factor caused trees now gliding by from one minor drainage to another until we came to the great Bitterroot proper, and the cottonwoods and feathery honey locusts lined its rushing edges. Once, when I was going the other way in August, a Limhi rancher told me the soil content of the Bitterroot was of such a makeup that the cows got skinnier, whereas in the Limhi, you know the rest. Of course, the Limhi is dry. It's like a boring, popular song. All by himself, he'd love to rest his weary head on somebody else's shoulder as he grows older. From Florence to Missoula is a very pragmatic distance. And Florence is the singularity Montana has. One is so drunk by that time. Fort Benton to your right, across stretches of the cuts of the Blackfoot, through Bauman's Corner. No, the sky is not bigger in Montana. When, for instance, you come from Williston, there seems at the border a change, but it is only because man has built a tavern there and proclaims himself of service. At a point in time, very much. And the space is continuous from Superior to Kalispell. And indeed, that is what the dirtiest of human propositions are built on. Service by men there before you could have possibly come, and you never can. But if men can live in Moab, that itself is proof nature is on the run and seeding very badly, and that environmentalism, old word, is truly dead. So he goes anywhere, apparently, anywhere, and space is muddied with his tracks for all he is after all. He is the most regretful factor in a too minuscule cosmic, the universe it turns out your neighbors are, the least obnoxious of all the radiating circles bring grossnesses that are of the strength of bad dreams. Let me remind you, we were in Florence, Montana, where the Bitterroot is thick past Hamilton, a farm machinery nexus for all that unnutritious hay, and in Florence we stop. Everyone gets out of the trucks and stretching and yawning moves through the biting, still, starlit night, a night covered with jewels, and the truck's radiators begin to creak and snap in their cooling off. We shiver. Each limb joint creaks and shudders, and we talk in clatters of the past road, of the failing headlights on the mountain road, and in we go. A wildly built girl brushes past us as we enter. Inside it is light, a funny disinherited place of concrete block. The fat woman bartender has an easy smile as we head for the fireplace in the rear, and as we go by the box is putting out some stomp and twist. And on the table by the fireplace there are canned things, string beans and corn, and she brings us the beer. Florence. It is hardly a place. To twist it, it is a wide spot. The air is cold. The fire burns into our backs while we sit on the hearth. The girl of the not-quite-believable frame returns, and her boyfriend is pulled by the rhythmically vertical tips of her fingers, reluctantly off the stool, but he can't. He, the conservative underwriting buttress of our planet, can't. He has been drinking beer while she, too young for a public place, has been pulling a bottle apart in the car. So there you are. She is as ripe and bursting as that biblical pomegranate. She bleeds spore in her undetachable black pants, and not to make it seem too good, or even too remote, or too unlikely near, she has that kind of generous smile, offset by a daring and hostile look. Again, I must insist, her hair was black, the color of hostile sex, the lightest people, for all their odd beauty, are a losing game. I can't leave her. Her mother was with her. She in the tavern in Florence was ready with all her jukebox body and her trips to the car, to the bottle. There are many starry nights thus occupied while the planet, indifferent, rattles on like the boxcars on its skin. And when moments like that transpire, they with all good hope begin again somewhere. She made many trips to the car that night, an unmatchable show-off with her eyes and other accomplishments. And onward, bless us, there are no eyes in Missoula, only things. The new bridge across Clark Fork, there is civilization again, a mahogany bar and ticker tape for baseball, and the men are men, but there are no eyes in Missoula. Like in Little Arthur Nanny, and is the sky bigger there? I personally announce the sky to be no bigger there. This may seem selfish. I can't allow Montana a particular size of sky because Finks like Mansfield live there, and the sky disdains itself to be thus associated, and treacherous cowboys who drive cars live there. You know that, as elsewhere. It is truly no bigger. Say the purity of blue over Houston, that unwholesome place, is prettier, and the graininess over Michoacan is moodier, and I have been to Wyoming anyway. The trip back, sadly, as all trips back are, dull, and I did see the old bartender woman in Florence, this time in her restaurant parked 50 yards away from the tavern between which she ran, apparently, with the speed of some sort of stout gazelle, but not the broad with the fabulatory build. She that day was probably off in an office somewhere. Pity daytime lives. But everyone was tired. We had unloaded the furniture. Early the next morning, and before the bite of the sun quelled the bite of the stars, we left, going the long, time-consuming way south. Sober business. The beauty of North Fork was there as she will be till she dies sometime. And by the way, she runs a tavern. Thence across to Salmon, and across the narrow bridge, and out into the Limha. I say, if it weren't for the distances and for the trees and creeks, I would go mad. Oh yes, land that one forces, a secondary interest in, vanishes as a force as you drive onward. This is only obvious. This is only some of the times we spend. You go through it as though it were a planet of cotton wadding, and love its parts as you do the parts of a woman whose relations with earth are more established than your own. But a physical entirety, there is no need to elaborate. One has one's foot on the ground, which is the saying of all common and communicable pleasures, and my arm around your shoulder is the proof of that. But I am ashamed of my country, that not as aerial reality, but as act, it shames me to be a citizen in the land where I grew up. The very air chills your bones, the very ungraciousness of its replies and the pressures of its not replying embarrass my presence here. God knows what we do what we can to live, but the intimidation thrown at us in the spurious forms they have learned truth can take in a time which should have been plenty and engaging of the best of each man, if he were encouraged to be even that. And not slapped in the face as stupid, cut off from all other peoples, to make him hygienic of views not viable to this soil, which is no more than sacred, I tell you. For she in her roundness has kept in accord with her movements, great time has not yet seen aberrant. Mice calling on a moving body, may they really offset great movement? The very air, if you are awake, can chill your bones, and there is little enough of beauty finally scratched for. It is not the in pursuit of my countrymen that they be great in a great line of men. An occasional woman won't, though I wish she could, justify a continent. In the parliaments of minuscule places, she is there and gives them substance, as in Florence and Norfolk, for she was gracious as leaders are now not, and I begin to believe after all these years there is an aristocracy of place and event and person, and as I sit here above this valley I sought to involve you with and take you out of on a trip that had not one point, there remains Montana, and it is very nice, but not infallible. The sky is a hoax and was meant, once suggested, to catch your eye. The sky can be arbitrary, but its subject matter cannot. Thus the beauty of some women, and from Williston, along the grand Missourian length of the upper plains you go, then the milk to Haver, that incredible distance once along a route of all those clamorous men, They now grow things that are not horticultural, only storageable, things of less importance than fur, for furs then were never stockpiled. It would hurt the hair. That aster, he'd never have done it. And yes, Fort Benton is lovely and quiet. I would gladly give it as a gift to a friend, and with pride, a place of marked indolence where the river closes, a gift of marked indifference, if it were mine. If the broad grass park were mine, between the river and the town, to the quick rise behind. And then up to the median altitude of Montana, sugar beets and sheep and cattle, where the normal far are the stretches of Wyoming and North Dakota, Idaho is cut by an elbow of mountain that swings down. Thus she is cut off by geology, she says, I'm sure, are natural, but it is truly, but it truly remains she is the West as no other place, ruined by an ambition and a religion cut by a use of her nearly virgin self, unannealed by a true placement, this. This is the birthplace of Mr. Pound.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a-plowing through the ragged skies, and up a cloudy draw. Ghost heard in the sky. Their brands were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel.
This is WPVM 103.5 FM on your radio dial and available also 24/7 on the web at WPVM.org. That was a wonderful sliding syntax by Dorn there. Really remarkable stuff. I'd love to see my high school English teacher diagram a couple of those sentences. I think it would be a challenge. Coming right up, we're going to be listening to another reading by Ed Dorn, one of a later work, one he created after his comic masterpiece Gunslinger, and that's a whole show in itself, or maybe two. Dealing with history again, the West, and especially the Apache people. It's Recollections of Gran Apacheria. I recorded this in Buffalo in April 1974.
Most of you are here because you know something of him. You don't need me to define where Ed's at for you. He's going to be reading from a new book that will be soon published. And that's really, I think, all an introduction needs to say is, here's Ed Dorn.
Okay, the book I'm reading now is called Recollections of Gran Apacheria, and it's a series of small portraits and it's a kind of a situational analysis For those of you who don't really know what a phrase like grana patri encompassed, it was that area the Spanish demarked as Gran Apacheria, from about central Texas to maybe the Arizona, California line, the river, the present river boundary, east and west, and maybe some point northern Chihuahua, say Panos would be a good town actually to take it from, to central Colorado, a kind of, that would be the extent of the area. And obviously other people besides the Apache lived there, but since, I mean, in another way, though the others didn't count, that's what they called it, Gran Apache. I'm really more concerned with the Western Apache in this case. I don't know what else I have to say about it. It's kind of runs itself in a way. So let me read, I'll read the first lines. It is bright to recollect the first law of the desert, the children of both sexes. They are of many clans. There is a season of gold along this spine of Dragoon Mountains. Tallow shampoo so the hair is sleek and obedient. When Victorio was killed accidentally, Victorio's sister was no Pocahontas. We call his mother Juana. Friends from boyhood, great hardness in old age. When Geronimo was in Washington for the inauguration, General Crook proved to a skeptical world, who can tell what a traitor is? Captain Emmett Crawford, when the Boundary Commission, a treacherous, fiendish look. Bartlett, this material yields. There was a time, the longest continuous run. The women circle the men in conference. The original monuments of perception. Out of the sunset movement, so the infant is bound. They were sentenced to observe. The train has come to rest and ceased its creaking. It is bright to recollect that the Apache were noble, not in themselves so much as in their ideas. The first law of the desert, to which animal life of every kind pays allegiance, is endurance and abstinence. The children of both sexes had perfect freedom and were never punished. They were wired to the desert, and they were invisible in the mountains. They are of many clans. They usually take their names from the natural features of localities, never from animals. Victorio. There is a season of gold before the energy of a people comes to its ritual close. And this is a metaphor not satisfied by the minds. There is no call to mourn the death of Victorio. He was spared the trivial meanness of imprisonment and slavery. No principles generated by a moral quandary in time. And in fact, Apache heads were rather amused by Oklahoma. See the pictures of Geronimo's band riding in dormant automobiles or holding the biggest pumpkin. Yet his taste for death is the bitterness we find on our tongue when we consider La Grana Pachuria. He is the most dreaded, the most terrible, the most famous. Nana and Victorio. Along this spine of Dragoon Mountains, the pains in Nana's bit-off leg, a wound inflicted by the vicious teeth of the alien church, their thin line moves north, then south, across the Rio Bravo del Norte. The wind driving the wildfire of their loyalties. And in the cruel vista, I can see the obdurate jewel of all they wanted, shining without a single facet upon our time. And yet the radiance marks everything as we unweave this corrupted cloth. Dress for war. Tallow shampoo so the hair is slick and obedient. Vermilion for the face and blue micaceous stone whose dust glitters weirdly. From a conejo deer, an inch wide band of blood from ear to ear. Copper ore for green stripes. The best army field glasses with which to sweep Hades. The most absolute of the predatory tribes, Apache policy was to extirpate every trace of civilization from their province. Bounty time. When Victorio was killed accidentally by a breed named Mauricio in Chihuahua, the smug governor of that province awarded the killer 3,000 silver pesos and a nickel-plated rifle, which several years later another Apache was to grab from the hands of the bear and blow a close-range hole in the stomach of Sing. This was not the importance of Victorio's death. For at this point, Victorio's sister assumed joint command with Nana, then 80, of the incorrigibles, who flew back to Tejas to clean up the landscape. The provoking figure of the horsewoman. Victorio's sister was no Pocahontas. She must have been something besides the product of vicious, unfair reporting. That she could split a barrel cactus with the sharp edge of her glance. Like to see white eye throat tore out. Like to smell that mind spill over the ground. And all over Mexican ground, most of all. Terrible dreams of Janus, where Mangus lay out dying, and the Mexican surgeon, under commission to save his life, or get that whole town burned down because it was old ground, where everything white eye policy strives for from the south, to mix himself, Tom Mix, over the horizon in endless numbers, blue endless coats, turned, like everything else in the present century, to something khaki, looking vaguely like shit. Geronimo. We call his mother Juana. She had him near Tularosa, rocket country still. Notorious through his opposition to the alien authority and by systematic and sensational advertising, his pleasures were widely known as depredations among the invader. Eyes like two bits of obsidian with a light behind them. Who Who and Geronimo? Whoa. Whoa and Geronimo. Friends from boyhood in Chihuahua and Arizona, perfecting their senses in the portable forge of summer, got down to the Mother Mountains, their obsessive democracy blown out at the points of control. Crazy with permission, a noiseless ecstasy only they can hear, each man permitted more than a man can bear against the true as steel military republicanism of the Norte Americanos. General Miles imagined that Geronimo didn't know the function of the heliograph. Nanai. Nanai. Great hardness in old age. He can be imagined straight from the flaking slopes. He can be imagined straight from the flaking slopes. A strong face, marked with intelligence, courage, and good nature, but with an understratum of cruelty and vindictiveness. He has received many wounds from the whites. Muchas gracias, amigos. In his countless fights with the whites. Muchas gracias, amigos. In each ear it was his pleasure to wear a huge gold watch chain. When Geronimo was in Washington for the inauguration of Roosevelt, he was interviewed at the Indian Hotel by S.M. Huddleston, his translator, at the Department of Agriculture. Geronimo signaled through George Ratton that he wanted to know where Huddleston lived, and was surprised and disappointed to learn that Huddleston lived in only one house on only one street. When Geronimo was in Washington for the inauguration of Roosevelt, he was interviewed at the Indian Hotel by S.M. Huddleston of the Department of Agriculture. Geronimo signaled through George Ratton, his interpreter, that he wanted to know where Huddleston lived, and was surprised and disappointed to learn that Huddleston lived in only one house on only one street. "Ugh," he said in gruff disgust, and signaled that if he were to live in the city, he would live in every house in it. $1,500 tons of hay at a penny a pound. General Crook proved to a skeptical world that even the Apache were corruptible. He put them to work in the hills at Fort Apache with butcher knives and small sickles. The moving invisible specter of the fratry on the traitor Peaches. Peaches actually was a famous kind of post-Indian. He did some time in California. I don't remember what the charge was, but when he returned, he was a cooperative. Who can tell what a traitor is? To what? His own comfort? Are there any traitors to that? Those dying of discomfort can accommodate it most. The brave arise less often than the cowardly, yet the group must, somewhere, remember the mistakes of low and common tendency, even when it is a mistake itself, when the cowardly are too remembered. What sets these things on their course? What participle of this history comes to have the label decisive moment? It was known to be Peaches, caught out, who revealed the escape route. And when, above Janos, we asked permission of the women to strangle the children, and the women consented, and the suicide gripping of the throats of our own children was done, and those delightful voices lay silenced in absolute sacrifice in the burrows where we hid, we slipped out through the light from Captain Garcia's raging grass fire, once more to the Sierra Madre, once more past the jaws of your hungry God, the frenzy of survival rushing from our pores. A period portrait of sympathy. Captain Emmett Crawford, commander of Apache scouts, is sated with German romanticism. His eyes are sunk deep in centuries of masturbatory introspection. On his chest, two ranks of buttons and a complicated rigging of braid. He has a dark, lost look in the style of Poe, and the scouts love his weirdness. When the Boundary Commission, following Kearney's capture of New Mexico in 1846, arrived at Santa Rita, trouble arose. Because naturally the miners had pushed some red-hot bayonets through the natives. And when they moved west to get this line on paper and out of the Membrano heart into Chiricahua, they were surveying a border long established by Apache force. And the Gadsden Purchase was made to correct an error of omission. Assorted compliments. A treacherous, fiendish look, Bartlett. Some have a Chinese cast of countenance, Smart. More miserable looking objects I never beheld, Fremont. Coal black eyes, Peters. Physically of slighter build than any Indians I've seen, Clum. Sonde Vosom, La Chapelle. Geronimo is the worst Indian who ever lived, General Miles. Tall, majestic in figure, muscular, Brance Mayer. Fine physical conformation, Foot. They live entirely by the chase, Delgado. Slim, very agile, features emotionless, flat, hair not unlike bristles, Bancroft. La carne del caballo, Velasco. They are said to be more fond of the meat of the mule than that of any other animal, Greg. Reservations. Reservations. This material yields only insofar as the reality was digested at the occurrence. This material, and this includes the famous greatness of the BAE, is the dung and piss of warfare's invariance. There is the Arabness of the subject. And it is the supreme form of the argument that foreign policy has always been an internal policy at the heart of the American inability to propagate a central thought. At the base of it, one finds the Northern Europeans' marked inability to live on Earth with other kinds, and certainly not with kinds other than themselves. But that this manicness is directed like a death ray, even to their own kind, is the ultimate difference. For instance, in our terrain, Bandelier's wretched, derisive reception at Fort Apache, riding on a half-ass, half-horse, or Cushing indistinguishable among the Zuni fruit sellers. It now looks as if their strategic mistake was in not interbreeding with the native blood in the first days and extensively thereafter. Their enforcement of the dispersion of the slave blood, of course, doesn't count. That use is only a marriage of convenience, derived from industrial and technically social considerations, and includes none of the innateness in which the conqueror joins the conquered. Love is corrupted by white eye policy throughout the hemisphere, where it is taken for necessity and where it must contend in a soil of distractions, always the conqueror waiting for the spaceship at the edge of the page, and whose biggest footnote is an apocalypse prior to themselves. Those who have seen in this some higher, drier destiny of the person have seen it in the small alienations of the color-coded wires of the culture, but it isn't there. In this case, it is poco a poco in the fabrications of the air, turning back the sunlight, promoting the early return of the glacier, and it is also possibly, in line with our habitual craziness, absolutely nowhere. We do not even yet know what a crisis is. Creation. There was a time when nothing existed. This time was before form. Time rolled on, and space, which derives its character from time, was not distinguished. Now there appears a spot, a thin circular disk, no larger than the hand, yellow on one side, white on the other, in mid-air. The first distinction is naturally given. It is to be as pure conception, not genetically argued. Included in the disc, there is a bearded figure the size of a hand. He is the Skyman, the agency of the metaphor, the one who lives above. He wakes as from a long sleep. He rubs his face and eyes with both hands, and where his eyes light, light appears everywhere, above and below, a sea of light. A glance to the east, light associated with black. The south, the full spectrum. The west, saffron. The north, blue. The one then cast out a ball, rolled from the sweat of the brow, and up sprung the parentless girl. Woman created first out of a direct act of labor, not from some spare part. Night girl is the nucleus of the universe. Some other one then asked, "Where is the earth?" And the one replied to this voice of the story, "I am thinking, thinking. I am thinking, thinking. I am thinking earth." And then he thought a little boy. And poco a poco, the whole phylum was brought into being. There was great laughter in the beginning when all creatures could talk. The whole European distinction. The longest continuous run of external resistance, the Apache Wars, without significant intermission from the 17th century onward, can only be attributed to the superiority of native over alien thinking. And yet they had not invented mind. And as we know, their domain was by mind overridden. In all the treaties, the native assented to the thinking, and never, and have not yet discovered, the predictive mind. Personam. The women circle the men in conference. They speak like a loud annotation to every advance of thought. They are theologically overheard. Those who overhear them log each nuance of the record. A clinic attention to the future is not to their nature. They ask more of the immediate utterance. They have no mechanic of the future, and they are prepared to meet the animate. If now they lie dormant, they were by mind overcome. I have a mind is the highest mutation of force. The original monuments of perception are the play of light through the wall's membrane. Out of the sunset movement, out of the sunrise invasion. So, the infant is bound hand and foot to the cradle board, a platform with roof, balcony onto the world, shield to the sun lance. They began life in this manner, devoted to pure observation from head to knock. And of course without the petty distraction of their fingers waving pathologically at the future. Because it is from witness, they made no natural cause to fear the future. Their art was of cosmic physical proportion, the scale proposed for everything and reflected in their land form. Their leading ideas come directly from their land form. By the time they are let out, they have seen it first, from the frantic jog of escape to the just plausible image of the desert floor. And what is before them invites them to be ready. The slipping of the wheel. They were sentenced to observe the destruction of their world. The revolutionary implications are interesting. They embody a state which our still encircled world looks toward from the past. Immured in Florida. Immured in Florida. Immured in Florida. La Machina a Houston. The train has come to rest and ceased its creaking. We hear the heavy breathing of the Machina, a relic in its own time, like all the manifestations of technical art, and without real gender, and hidden from direct appeal by the particulates of the English language, itself the agent of fragmentation, and lonely accuser of the generic lines, the heavy breathing of the lonely Machina, stopped in its tracks, waiting for the photograph. The Apache are prodded out into the light, Remember, there are still dark places then, even in the solar monopoly of Arizona and Tejas. We are with the man with the camera. They step off the train and wait among the weeds. They never take their eyes off of us. Wise practice. We motion the way with our shotguns. They are almost incredibly beautiful. We are struck and thrilled with the completeness of their smell. To them we are weird, while to us they are not weird. To them we are undeniable, and they stop only before that. They are like us, yet we are not like them, since we don't recognize that. We say, one cannot have a piece of what is indivisible, is natural Apache policy. Where for us, that is a philosophical implication. We are alike, but we see things from behind dissimilar costumes. The first principle of warfare. Where all of us is the army and they are the people. Precisely they step off the train, and this is an important terminal moment in the rush hour begun in this hemisphere. This is the moment before the leg irons. They look good. They look better than we do. They will look better than we look forever. We will never look really very good. We are too far gone on thought and its rejections, the two actions of a noose. We are struck and thrilled. Natchez sits alone in the center because he is the elegant one among them. Hereditary, proper as a dealer, he is inherent and most summary of themselves. Supple, graceful, flexible hands, good-natured, fond of women. As the train moves off at the first turn of the wheel, with its cargo of Florida-bound exiles, most all of whom had been put bodily into the coaches, their 3,000 dogs, who had followed them like a grand party, to the railhead at Holbrook, began to cry when they saw the smoking creature resonate with their masters. And as the machina acquired speed, they howled and
moaned, a frightening noise from their great mass, and some of them followed the cars for 40 miles before they fell away in exhaustion. Just to complete Dorn's poem there. Back in 74, in the days of analog tape, I had to watch helpless as the tape slipped through the capstan, slapped against the heads with each rotation of the reel as Dorn read on. And that's wordplay for this week. Music today by The Shadows, Vaughn Monroe, Peter Cater, and R. Carlos Nakai. The Ed Dorn recordings are available on the net at the Slot Foundation and Penn Sound. Wordplay is produced in the studios of WPVM. Thanks so much for joining us.